Okay, guys, we are up to class eight. Obviously, we've had a number of scholars, residents, other educators. Okay, tonight we're going to continue our quest. We're up to the, we're going to try to deeper appreciate Moshe Rabbeinu. And the way we're going to try to do that is to, when most people relate to the characters in the Tanakh, like in the Hebrew school kind of way, which is basically cartoonish and mythical, okay? Because, you know, there is this world called Chumash world. And in Chumash world, there's this character called Moses. And he does miraculous things, okay? So that's a stage of life. That's good. But now that you guys are fully adults and you guys are educated, I want to provide a deeper appreciation of who Moshe Rabbeinu is. And basically what we're going to do tonight is that you could simply say Moshe Rabbeinu essentially is a blending of three personalities, three prototypes, three archetypes in one. He was Israel. He was, you know, during the 40 years, and then he was the king. He was the leader. He never went to Israel, but of the Jewish people, of the Jewish people. Number two, he was the spiritual leader. So he was initially the Kohen, initially, and until he was able to offload that to his
brother
Aaron, who became the Kohen Gadol. And obviously, he's the chief educator. He's a Torah leader. He's Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe our teacher. Okay, so what we did, like last time we had class together, we utilized Martin Luther King to appreciate another kind of leadership. Here we're going to, and a couple weeks before that, we looked at Herzl, which was another kind of leader. So here we're going to, this might be introducing, some people may know, three leaders, three Jewish leaders of the 20th century we're going to go into tonight. One, maybe no one knows about, maybe one, maybe Jonathan Sanker, because he's, okay. Raise your hand if you heard the name Zev Jabotinsky.
Yes. Oh, wait, I just saw something.
He is Russian.
Yes.
He was Russian. He never went to Israel.
Did he go to Israel?
He never got to Israel. I mean,
okay. Jonathan writes about him in the history of the Jews.
Yes, very important person. Okay, good. So we're going to give you, if you didn't ever heard of Zev Jabotinsky, we will give you the crash course. We'll educate you. And then, of course, we're going to show the connection to Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay, because he represents a dimension of Moshe Rabbeinu. Well, I'm going to ask you, what is that dimension? Okay, so we'll get to that. All right, so let's go to we have tonight's a rare three-video situation. Three video clips plus the Rambam. I'm trying to squeeze it in.
Relax,
all right, so we might go to our full, we might use our full pantomime speak. So I'm going to try to.
Hold off on clicking
the video until
when I open
this. You can do that. Okay, here we go.
I don't know video.
Anybody has a charger?
What do you mean by charger?
Yeah.
For your phone?
Yeah.
It's going to be more specific. A lot of different type of chargers out there.
Okay, hit the lights. Okay, guys, hit the lights. We have to have... All right, David, I'm going to step away so you'll block this. I'll stop blocking.
Okay.
That's facts.
Here we go. This is a short version of Zev Jabotinsky in 2 minutes. Here we go.
Jabotinsky. Zev Jabotinsky was born in 1880 in Odessa, then in the Russian Empire, and lost his father when he was only six. Jabotinsky mastered many languages and was recognized at a young age as a poet, author, and journalist who often used the pen name Altalena. Following massacres against Russian Jewry, Jabotinsky joined the Jewish Defense Force and the Zionist movement. During World War I, Jabotinsky established the Jewish Legion, the first Jewish military force in 1800 years. He was awarded a military citation for his bravery and valor. In 1920, he was jailed for organizing a Jewish defense force in Jerusalem. Due to public pressure, Jabotinsky's sentence was shortened to 3 months, not enough time to complete the translation of Dante's Divine Comedy, to the great dismay of lovers of literature. Jabotinsky established the revisionist movement, which took a hard line against British policy, the youth movement Bitar, and also served as the supreme commander of the Etzel military underground. Jabotinsky promoted the learning of Hebrew in schools across the land of Israel and throughout Europe. Jabotinsky's ideological principles included the five essentials a country must provide for its citizens, an iron wall, an independent strong army, which would cause the Arabs to abandon their military missions and accept Israel's presence. In 1930, the British authorities exiled Jabotinsky and prevented him from ever returning to Palestine. In 1940, Jabotinsky arrived in the United States in an attempt to create a Jewish military force in order to fight the Germans, but sadly he died of heart failure. Only 25 years later, Jabotinsky was reburied in Jerusalem.
Okay, so so does anybody, without looking at the sheet, who is the most prominent disciple of Zev Jabotinsky alive today?
Bibi
Netanyahu. His father was his personal secretary. Now, Bibi Netanyahu's father died when he was 105 years old, was a professor, wrote a number of books. One, he wrote a scholarly book on Yvar Benel. Great book. I read it. And he was an ardent disciple of Zev Jabotinsky's perspective. He is essentially the ideological father of Israel, of the right wing, Likud and all the right wing parties in Israel to this very day. What was the last thing you saw? What was the last thing you saw that Israel must have?
The Iron Wall.
Basically, the point is, the theory is, their theory is as follows: you create a physical wall necessarily, but basically you create a tough military force that, to the point where the Arabs will give up trying to destroy you. Or you don't negotiate. You just hold the line, and until they recognize your existence. Okay.
Is it a figurative iron wall, or is it a physical?
It's a figurative iron wall. They're not against walls. They built the wall around major parts of the West Bank, or you want to call it disputed territories, whatever your Yehuda Shomron. But principally, their iron wall thing is really the Israeli Defense Force. That's the iron wall. In other words, basically, we're not going to, going back to Zev Jabotinsky's life, what was a major turning point? I don't know if you guys caught that. What was a major point in his life that was really?
Pogroms.
Yeah, the 1903 Kishinev pogroms in Russia. It was also a cause of tremendous immigration from Russia. Any people, if you have great-grandparents from Russia, who immigrate to America, that was a major factor. They basically, Cossacks came and just killed and raped, pillaged people. Hundreds of people died. It was horrible. And basically, his basic thing is that a Jew has to learn how to shoot. A Jew has to learn how to defend themselves because nobody's going to be there for us. That's the very point. That's to this very day. The IDF's basic standard, we need to be able to take care of ourselves because nobody's going to do it for us. No matter what the United States says and what the allies say, you cannot rely on the goodwill of the Western world because they will let us down. Doesn't mean you don't have allies, but but you don't rely upon them exclusively. You do your best to be able to have an autonomous self-defense, specifically if you're in the most dangerous neighborhood in the world. Okay. Now, what's that got to do with Moshe Rabbeinu?
Similar, he saw a Jewish guy being hit by the Egyptians.
Right. Did he sit down with the Egyptian and says, let's have a cup of coffee. Let's discuss this conflict. Let's discuss about this unjust domination of the Jewish people. What did he do? He saw an injustice. He took a large blunt object and he killed the Egyptian. And then he looked both ways, make sure he wasn't going to get caught, and then he buried him. All right, so he felt there was, I'm not going to go through that whole point, but basically he felt that there's a situation where there is, in other words, a Shir Hashirim. Kohelet says for every season, you know, there's this, you know, for every season, time for, you know, time for love, time for sadness, whatever, all the different possibilities. What is Eit La Shalom, but Eit La Milchama? What does that mean? Eit La Shalom. Time for peace. Eit La Milchama. Time for war. Jews are not pacifists. We're not warmongers. You have to use your wisdom. When is the appropriate stance? Moshe Rabbeinu felt that there was not time for a negotiation again with the Egyptians. He killed the Egyptian who was basically threatening the Jews' life. Similarly, when he goes to Midian, what does he see there? He sees there's Yitro's daughters are at the well. He's at the well. What does he see?
Them harassing her.
Right. Their other shepherds are harassing them, basically taking their water. What does he do? He steps in, kicks their butt, doesn't kill them, and basically rescues them from the shepherds, and then waters their flock. Okay, so the point being is that Zev Jabotinsky really represents the role of the Jewish king. The role of the Jewish king is to be the, like in America, the commanding officer, the commander in chief. Okay, the Jewish king is also the head of the Jewish army. Just like in America, the president is also the commander in chief. Okay, and that means there are certain people that you do have. There's a mitzvah to. Try to negotiate peace. There's a mitzvah to do that. But if there's not agreement of peace, you have an obligation to go to war. Okay? So there's complicated halacha. When you do one thing, when you do the other. But I'm just saying there is a time for war. So that, what Zev Jabotinsky's contribution to modern Jewish life is basically insisting, before there was a state of Israel, that there should be, you know, during World War I, there should be a Jewish legion. There should be, and then he went to Israel. I forgot about that. I forgot he just kicked out. He was there for, I don't know, maybe 8 years until he was kicked out by the British, and trying to organize a Jewish army. He died actually. Those who know Rabbi Sacks, he lives in Hunter, New York. He died in Hunter, New York, because he started an organization called Beitar, which is still around today, which is a secular Zionist, and in that day, very more militant. And they would have part of their camp, they had a camp of Hunter, where they would learn like basic military, self-defense and military stuff, like a military, paramilitary camp, okay? So that's really number one, that's Zev Jabotinsky. So there's a part to deal with the ongoing threat. We say every year at the Seder, the whole door of a door, Om Demalin Lachal, Tainu Vakarish Baruch Hu Masin Yadam, in every generation they rise to the guests, and God saves us from their hands. But God expects us not just to sit there passively, but to do what we can do. And that means to have an army, okay? And that means to learn self-defense. So, you know, first of all, I think every person here, does everybody here have learned like the basics of karate and judo? You should, every person, every Jew should. Yes. I'm just saying that a Jew should know how to protect themselves. Okay? You should learn the basics of self. What?
I know martial arts.
Okay. Whatever the method is, Krav Maga, whatever it is, you should not, a Jew should never be a passive victim. Okay? That's basically Zev Jabotinsky's message. And Benjamin, who else was readout? Who else was his students? Very seminal people. Menachem Begin. So Menachem Begin. So Ben Gurion was on the left, the Labor Party, Mapai, left wing, and they were much more obviously more oriented toward negotiation. And Menachem Begin was the not taking much more militant stance. So he's the founder of Likud, which took over the government in 1977. Okay, you read a person who was there was his defense minister, which is Moshe Arendt. He narrated a little clip, and was also a personal. He was a leader of Zev Jabotinsky's Beitar, correct? And Ariel Sharon, General Sharon, also the Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, who passed away, also a big, student of. So his thought, even though he didn't live a long time, is that ideology of Jewish self-defense in the state of Israel is a major position that really we're about to have elections in Israel. You guys remember that coming up. So half the government, half the parties, or the little mini parties that are going to represent, are basically some half of them, roughly 50% or 60%, identify with Zev Jabotinsky's ideology. Okay, to varying degrees. So that's, you need to know that guy. So there's a part of, to understand Moshe, there's a part of Moshe which is Zev Jabotinsky-esque. Not complete, but there's a dimension there, okay?
There's one other thing that I'm trying to connect to Moses, was he came from this, like, very, like Odessa, like, where he was not a shtetl Jew, like, he came from this very secular, modern, cosmopolitan background. He wrote poetry. He was a journalist,
kind of
like Herzl.
Right. And Moshe was also both very well, had a very highly educated thing. And his, which is very interesting, that you can read on Tablet magazine. They had a or Mosaic, one of those online magazines. He wrote in his relationship with Judaism, and observance. He had a very, he had like the basic Hebrew school, bar mitzvah, one and done thing, but a very passionate Jew, and his connection to Judaism, and then conceiving what should be his role in the state of Israel, very interesting. And he went back and forth. Hill Hykind, a great author. He wrote a very good article on that. So if you want to do further reading, Google that, and you'll.
I'm reading his book.
He wrote many good books. So that's okay. That's our first crown. The crown of. By the reason why. The Pirkei Avot refers to these various things as crowns. Keter Torah, the crown of Torah. Keter Kahuna, the crown of the priesthood, and Keter Torah. All right, now we're going to go to Keter Torah, which is also named the synagogue in Tina, because we go to here we go, next thing. Okay, maybe one or two of you have seen this video. Okay, this is a thing for sure, Shana. Okay, there we go. I'll hit the lid.
Literally un-American. He's too modern. He's too secular.
He didn't look to his right. He didn't look to his left. He never did anything because he was worried what somebody else might think. He did it because he was principled and felt that this was the most appropriate and only way to be.
It was a difficult road, and the road helped us hold our heads high. We needed to hold our heads high.
He saw himself as an illuminator in people's minds rather than a controller of people's minds.
He never saw such a teacher before. He was literally a tiger in a cage. Up and back, up and back. Those flashing black eyes. He was just different from Deagle.
We simply share the concerns of man in general. But at the same time, we have interests and concerns of our own. We are part of humanity. At the same time, we are alone.
You came across as a figure who was deeply torn. He writes about that. He has a sense of a life in tension, torn between two worlds, aware of great complexity. He was heads and shoulders above everyone else. He was unique. He was one of a kind. By definition, that makes you lonely.
I am lonely because in my humble, inadequate way, I am a man of faith. For whom to be means to believe.
All right.
Did he get his book?
Now this is, they made a documentary of it. Okay, so, somebody want to read the paragraph? Just a little bit of a summary here. Who would like to read? Okay, Samantha back from Abu Dhabi. Get to read.
Oh.
What is it like? What is it like? What is it like? For, it was like Friday for you right now? Yeah. I'm just teasing. You. 8 hours ahead of you.
Nine.
9 hours. Beautiful. Well, good morning to you. Let's keep on going. Keep on going.
Lonely Man of Faith deals with the life and legacy of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, who arguably was the most influential leader of the American Jewish community in the 20th century. Over the course of his more than 4 decades at Yeshiva University, where he ordained 2,000 rabbis, more than any other figure in the world, he was widely acknowledged and widely recognized, but at the same time, he was an important philosophical thinker. Rabbi Soloveitchik spent most of his life trying to negotiate between the demands of Judaism and the opportunities of the modern age, and the struggle became a constant theme throughout his writings and teachings. He encouraged his community to accommodate the positive developments of modernity. While fighting those trends, he perceived as negative, such as increased secularism and excessive socialism. Now, over 3 decades after his departure from the public scene, Rabbi Soloveitchik's impact reverberates even today, as his students, friends, and family continue to debate his complicated legacy.
Okay, so there you have in a clear visual form a person whose communication of Torah has, I mean, nobody could walk into MJE, even though nobody was even probably born to meet Rabbi Soloveitchik, without the ideas, without Rabbi Soloveitchik, there would be no MG, and there would be many institutions. So, as a Torah figure, he represents, you know, the Moshe Rabbeinu-esque kind of personality, whose depth of thought and communication of idea literally animates thousands. Obviously, Moshe Rabbeinu is that. What's more, you know what I'm saying? But as far as a modern figure to understand what that kind of person would be like, that's a 20th century person who best represents. So now, so far, we have in our mixing bowl, we have one scoop of Jabotinsky, one scoop of Rabbi Soloveitchik, and we go to our third scoop. Okay. The next one is the priest. Yes.
In the video, it had Maimonides, like on the cuts.
Yes.
Well, was that just...
Oh, so that was a very big deal. So one of the big things that people don't really know aware about this, but in the middle 30s, so he comes to, you saw, I don't know, they had a little clip of the New York Times saying 28-year-old rabbi comes to lead a 100,000 member Orthodox community of Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like, just the thought of that is like pretty stressful. So anyway, so when he came to Boston, and he was met with a world which was like this. There were only 10 people who were, out of the 100,000, they're basically, he said, 10 Shomer Shabbos Jews. A lot of people belonged to Orthodox synagogues back then, but were not Orthodox. That was a big deal. And everybody who was Shomer Shabbos was over 70. One of the reasons was because in the 30s, the work week was Monday through Saturday. Most jobs required you to work on Saturday. So that's why that was developed. Have you heard of the curve of the Hashkama Minyan?
Mm-hmm.
The Hashkama Minyan was developed so people could go to shul early on Shabbos morning, let's say 7 o'clock, be done at 8:30, make kiddush, and then go to your job.
What's funny is it becomes this like badge of honor of being more religious, right?
It's not so much more religious.
I'm not saying it's more religious. I'm saying that people kind of see themselves.
Yeah, because it's typically associated with a choir minion. Yeah. And also people want to avoid the fanfare and the dragged out length of a regular 9 o'clock, 9:30 regular standard synagogue experience. Okay? It's typically going to be an hour and a half, an hour 45. You're in, you're out. Hello and goodbye. Okay? That's what Hashkan Minyan is. There, but that really started because of people who wanted to be Shabbos observant, but it was economically too overwhelming for them.
What does Hashkan Minyan mean?
It means early morning.
So how does that tie
with the month? So that's his, thank you for keeping me up. So he comes there and basically he realized that if we don't have day school education, Jewish day school education, this Boston and by extension, American Jewry is done. Now in the 30s and 40s, Orthodoxy was so, was shrinking. People were ready to say that it will not last till 1950. There'll be no more Orthodox Jews. There'll be relics. So what he did was to start a day school, which is half-day Jew studies, half-day general studies. And the backlash he got was, that's un-American. If you're really American, you send your kids to public school, a private school. And this is American Jews, who are an immigrant community, wants to be assimilated, acculturated. So he started with six students. Six. And he would go, him and his wife would go fundraising, and he would go to people like five or six times and say no to him. But he was principal. He knew that this was critical. Because there was Maimonides, that also launched school throughout America. That became most kids went to public school, and then you went to Hebrew school, sometimes, you know, in the North, 4 days a week. It was a lot. But so until the 1950s, that was a regular. Then it became, in the Orthodox community, it became, you send your kid to day school till eighth grade. Then you went to public high school. Then in the 60s and 70s, they felt that's not really enough. The high school is where kids start to develop. You really need to have special, you know, serious education then. Then it became much more among the, to go send your kids to a Jewish high school as well, K through 12. And then starting in the 80s, it started to say, well, that's really not enough. You want to make sure the kid's successful in college, you want to send your kid to a gap year in Israel, a yeshiva or a seminary for that. That's pretty much like that. That's probably 70% of the Orthodox community today, okay? And then many of them, not only, about 25% send their kids to a Jewish college, a Jewish university, Stern College, or Touro College, or Land College, okay? That's the breakdown. So he started that. Again, tremendous opposition, because he knew, and he was right. And he was 100% right. He basically, at that point, the only sukkah was in the shul. Now you go to, anybody been to the Five Towns for Sukkot or for Teaneck for Sukkot, everybody has a sukkah. Conservative Jews have sukkahs. Back then, nobody had sukkahs. Or he brought, that mitzvah came back. A lot of other mitzvahs that were restored.
Wasn't there only one
mitzvah at all Manhattan? Yeah, right. It was very common for women not to be observant of Tarat HaMishpacha, except for the wedding. That was not uncommon. Certainly in the conservative movement, and then the modern Orthodox community was, and then that became much more prevalent to Tarat HaMishpacha, what they call family. Okay. Our third character of the night is Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. Rav Cook. Raise your hand if you heard about Rav Cook. All right, good. So we'll do something better. Okay, he's really the best example of it. He was actually technically a Kohen, but that's not really the definition of a Kohen. If you want to go to a Kohen, who is the ideal person of the Kohen? Which character in Tanakh represents the Kohuna, the priesthood in the highest level? Aaron. What's his feature? What are his qualities? What does Pirkei Avos say about him?
Shalom bias.
Close.
Or peace.
Shalom, yeah. He was Rode Shalom. He had a tremendous skill to create social harmony. So not only did he teach Torah, but he did in a way to really bring it, he had a tremendous sensitivity to people, was able to communicate Torah ideas that would be psychologically assimilated in a very positive way. Moshe is much more of a distant figure, a little bit scary. He's a scary sort of intellectual type. Aaron is going to guy. He's going to be a guy who's warm, approachable, encouraging. Okay.
Did we meet Rav Kook's grandson in Israel?
Great granddaughter. She gave us the Hadassah.
That's right. Okay. Next video. Here we go. This is a 30-minute video. We're going to get a little. Did it hit the light?
It's traditions.
Okay, hold on. I'm going to go big. Skip a little bit.
I was born in 1865 in Brive, Latvia. Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook was born in 1865 in Brive, Latvia. As the scion of a Hasidic family on his mother's side and a Lithuanian family on his father's, he studied with outstanding rabbis of both major Ashkenazic Jewish movements. He was quickly recognized as a prodigy and sent to study in the finest yeshiva in Lithuania, the Yeshiva of Voloshin. Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Berlin, the Netziv, who headed the yeshiva, said of the young Rav Kook that it was worthwhile establishing the Voloshin yeshiva, if only to teach a student like him. At the age of 30, he was called to serve as rabbi of the city of Polsk. Already then, he was revered as a leader able to integrate sacred study with public leadership. His vast wisdom and courageous rulings on day-to-day matters drew the eyes of all the communities in Yeshivot of Europe to him. The heart was drawn to one thing, Eretz Yisrael, the Holy Land of Israel. His early writings represented the initial stages of the teachings that would later serve as the engine of a national revival movement moving forward on the tracks of the Jewish heritage. 100 years ago, the Jewish leadership in Eretz Yisrael invited Rav Kook to serve as the rabbi of the city of Jaffa and surrounding agricultural communities. The Rav did not hesitate and set out upon a path that would shape the face of Judaism in Eretz Yisrael for many generations to come. It is difficult to determine how Rav Kook realized that the time had come. All we know is that he had wanted to come to Eretz Israel a long time earlier, but his father-in-law told him not to, that he shouldn't come as a private individual. He published his books under his own name, and in Eretz Israel, the residents of Jaffa, at the time a tiny city, saw them and said, "This is the rabbi for us." So they brought him from far off Lithuania all the way to Jaffa.
The first article he published in Eretz Yisrael after he came was Hador, The Generation. That was his introductory article, The Generation.
Before that, he also wrote very great things. But when he arrived in Jaffa, everything rose to an entirely different level.
If we penetrate its inner essence, we find that this is not a base generation, nor is it, in truth, a generation of sinners. Let us prepare for it a path, so that it may find what it seeks inside the borders of Israel. We will not deprive it of the good light. We will radiate upon it the light of life, with the light of truth, which illuminates from the source of the Jewish soul. And our children will gaze upon it and be illuminated by it.
He describes the generation.
Including social perfecting, such as tools to cultivate the land, wards, practical inventions. And there are also acts of spiritual perfecting that qualities in it will be revealed. And the spirituality should serve.
Hisham. Rav Kook had a unique attachment and love for the Jezreel Valley because he viewed it as the realization of the practical Zionist vision. The valley was a dream come true. To view Zionism as a messianic process. I've lived in the Jezreel Valley for 80 years. I never heard that expression used by our parents even once, that it was a messianic process. That is, that there is a superhuman process at work here. They considered it a revival process. Here they planted and sowed and so forth. For them, it had a different meaning, not a religious, mystical meaning, but rather a concrete, practical one. Perhaps for Rav Kook, this rebuilding of the land was a genuine solution to a very intriguing question. The abstract, spiritual, and mystical aspects of it could be detected with the senses, with the eye, by hearing, and so on. And here Rav saw, almost without any awareness on their part, without giving it a name, values being realized, values on the ground, for real.
Sorry, aspects. I got you. There's what to explain here. All right. All right. Here's the deal. So what they allude to, so Rav Kook shows up, what is the demographics in the state of Israel in the year 1905? Who's there? Which Jews are there?
1905.
Well, there are people, yeah, they, who he gave money to develop the Rishon LeZion, the that area where they grow grapes. Carmel, but what kind of what kind of Jews were there?
1935.
Secular.
Right. So the early Zionists were there were secular Jews, ardently secular Jews. In fact, in the Jezreel Valley, those neighborhood those communities, Star Kibbutzim had was the first Jewish settlements that were built without synagogues. How secular? That's pretty secular. They don't even have a synagogue. Not that we don't go to the synagogue, we don't even build one, okay? All right? We don't have a Beit Midrash, nothing, okay? Now, a lot of them grew up Orthodox, but they exchanged that Orthodoxy for the new religion called secular Zionism, okay? So he feels that he, as Rabbi Kook, he has to go out there and he has to be, and there, of course, there's also students of the Vilna Gaon who are in Jerusalem, okay? That's, so you have these two communities. You have super Haredi, black hat, super secular.
What exactly religion is secular Zionism?
It's a belief that the Jewish people should have their own land and therefore gain protection from that, and they should be involved and they should be a nation like all others, which will have a society, a civil society, which will have an economy, which will have a have all the features of a regular nation like France. It'll be a Jewish France in the Middle East. Okay, that's basically it. All right.
I feel like there's still a lot of people in Israel that have
Yeah, there are. There's the hardcore super secular, probably 10%. Then another 10% on top of that are secular-ish, you know. And then the middle group, the middle many, are what they call Mesorati, traditional. Ours, they'll have Kiddush, have Friday night dinner, movie anyone? Or they'll, no, ours.
How French Jews do.
Right. So they a lot of Jews like that. Right. So they have their traditional, the entire calendar in Israel is the Jewish calendar. So what's their day off? Shabbos. They celebrate Purim. Pesach, they'll have a Seder. In other words, they do all the stuff. They'll have a kid have a bris, but they don't go to shul that often. Bar mitzvah, special events, high holidays, occasions. Okay. That's the majority of Israelis. The middle many, okay? And then on the other side, you have about 25% Orthodox, and within the Orthodox, you have 30% are Haredi. I mean, that's a basic cut. Anyways, I want to show you one particular aspect. So anyways, Rav Kook goes with a bunch of rabbis to all those in the Jezreel Valley, to all these kibbutzim that have no synagogue. So how do you think he is welcome? Here's a guy who looks like a chassid. He dresses as a European Hasidic master. You see, he's wearing the wool hat, he's wearing the fur hat. It's like 9 degrees out. He's still wearing, like, he's in Lithuania. He has a two side. I don't know if you guys caught that. What are the two parts of his background?
Hasidic and Lithuanian. So he their marriage at that time.
Right. So he is, so his father was from a Lithuanian, which is a misnagid, anti Hasidic. And his mom, we see she was being there, the Lithuanian yeshivas before they were after the Holocaust transplanted to Israel and America. And then he has a Hasidic side. So he's his own category in a certain sense. He's a cook. When you go to Israel and you say the word, oh, have you ever learned the works of the Rav? Who will they think you are talking about?
Rav
Cook. He is their Rav. Even now, all the Gnaras, the Kippah Sugah, the Nip Kippah, when they go to Yeshiva, they learn his philosophy, his worldview. Okay? Just like we, you know, in the Modern Orthodox, you'll learn a lot more of our Soloveitchik. Okay? He's really he's the father of religious Zionism. Okay? Philosophically. Okay?
So if he's asked who the Rav is in Crown Heights?
They don't have the Rav. They have the Rebbe. The Rebbe is the Rebbe. Okay? That's clear. Okay. So anyway, so he shows up there. It goes like this. He goes into one of these yeshuvim. And he wants to connect with them. And one of the guys says, like, what are you doing here? You're not going to, you know, we're not going to be influenced by you. We're not going to be influenced by you. You're wasting your time. And he has the line. He says, I am not here to influence. I'm here to be influenced. So his idea was he wanted to go to these people who, in other words, why would a person go out into the Galil where it's a bazillion degrees in the summertime? There's no air conditioning. And you're secular. Why are you pulling out rocks out of the middle of a vacant field and dealing with malaria? Yeah, but why would you bother? If you're secular, just go to France and enjoy go. Or why aren't they, if you're going to be secular in America, when a person's secular, they go party. They don't go, I'm now going to live in a shack with no air conditioning or heating, and I'm going to make the desert blue. These are highly idealistic people. They're really what they call moser nefesh. They are giving up of themselves to, and obviously they dealt with the Arabs trying to shoot them, who obviously didn't want them there, and they're draining the swamps. So he felt in them, in his worldview, he felt there was a profound spirituality in these people, which they deny. What are we talking about? No, we're you know, practically involved in statecraft. No, you are actually building, since you are electing to build not Russia, not Spain, not France, not Britain, and you're specifically building up the Jewish homeland, that's a mitzvah. So he was, they felt in him an authentic love. And really what he communicated was and I think people who have learned of his work, is that he held, not as a tactic, not as a strategy, not as a manipulation, but it's sort of a belief of a true love of every Jew, no matter where they're at. So he walked in these places like, they're not just secular, they're virulently anti-religious. Like the most anti, and he walked in there, and they liked him. Now, how are people do that? What is he like? He's like a religious Houdini guy. So how did he do that? So he went there to listen to them, and he's an honest guy, and he's a very deep person, and he convinced them to keep kosher. How do you do that? How do you do that? He had the following. He said, look, we're brothers. We're family. We should be able to eat together. So I would like to eat here. And your brothers and sisters want to eat here. But we can't eat here if the food's not kosher. Now, it's not what he said. It's also, I wasn't there. He said in a way, not for religious reasons, but just as a sense of, we're the Jewish people. We're family. We should be able to get together. So then they say, well, we don't know how to keep kosher. He goes into the kitchen, gives them a crash course, koshers their kitchen, explains the basics to the people there. And here you have a secular moshavim. I mean, we don't, hardcore secular, turning their place kosher because he you know, this should be, we should be one people. Now, very few people, everybody believes in Jewish unity, but to be able to communicate that and effectively pull that off. And by the way, he's getting tremendous flack from the Orthodox. Like, why these people are haters of, in ours, because a lot of them were formerly Orthodox, in ours, what they call off the derech, you know, back then, and becoming super. So when a person was formerly Orthodox and becomes not Orthodox, often they go superly aggressively. I'm specifically going to smear some milk on this piece of meat. You know what I mean? It becomes what they call in Hebrew, tlahachas. I'm going to do it on purpose.
How come they do that? Because I've gone to...
Because it's a rebellion. It's
anger. I've gone to meals where, you know, certain people were, let's say, more right-wing or, like, homes. Yeah. Like, yeah. Not modern, but, like...
Yeshivish?
The two parents went in that direction, and the person, you know, is now really off the derrick, so you'd speak. And we've gone, and I know this person now for years, and it was like, first met the person years ago, you know, go to the home, completely polite, and it's got to the point, like, have a Shabbat meal, now it takes out the phone.
Right.
And I mean, it's like, but why? Like, it's
a rebellion. So when you're rebellious, you're not polite about it. I mean, it's just simple as that. I mean, it's more complicated than that. I'm not going to get the whole.
Yes. Person who's not Jewish comes to the home for
a time. Oh,
very.
Oh, yeah.
Perfect manners.
Oh, yeah. If you are at a workplace and you need to take off early for Shabbos, you want your boss to be not Jewish. Not, you know, secular or semi-traditional. You want, because a non-Jew is much, they don't claim to know what you just invented, and you tell them that you have to, you know, fine. I did a funeral in Seattle. Families reform. So they had it was a not Jewish funeral thing, and they never did a Orthodox. It was Nicola Johnson was the funeral director, not a Jew. But the best person to work with, Rabbi, whatever you want, very accommodating. I said, you know, we're going to add this to your resume. You're going to teach you how to do this. And I said, we're going to, you know, and I took it to the step by step. Super accommodating. If I dealt with somebody who was, let's say, Jewish but not religious, it would be like, then it becomes like a judging, and then, you know, you're not all bad. Okay. So anyways, my point being is, Rav Aaron Cohen Cook had that capacity to understand people, educate people. And Moshe Rabbeinu, who was really where the first job is this, had that quality as well. Okay? Let's read together really all these, by the way, who's the king, who's the ultimate going to be the future king? That's the Mashiach. Okay? That really is the character of the Mashiach. So has all is one part Jabotinsky, one part the Reich Soloveitchik is, and one part Rav Cook. Those three contemporary people blended together gives you a clear sense of the persona it takes to be the Mashiach and Moshe Rabbeinu, who was the first Mashiach, anointed person. Okay, who would like to read Tshuva, Lachanan? Okay, Casey, Bavakasha, go.
These reasons, all Israel in particular, their prophets and their sages, have yearned for the Messianic age so they can rest from the oppression of the Gentile kingdom, who do not allow them to occupy themselves with Torah mitzvot properly. They'll find rest and increase their knowledge in order to merit the world. In that era, knowledge, wisdom, and truth will become abundant. Isaiah states, the earth will be full of the knowledge of God. Jeremiah states, one man will no longer teach his brother, nor a man his colleague, for all will know me. And Ezekiel states, I will take away the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. These changes will come about because the king who will arise from David's descendants will be a greater master of knowledge than Solomon and a great prophet, close to the level of Moses, our teacher. Therefore, he will teach the entire nation and instruct them of God. All the Gentile nations will come to hear him as it will come to pass in the last days that the mountain of God's house shall be established at the peak of the mountains and all the nations shall flow to it. Nevertheless, the ultimate of all reward and the final good, which will have no end or decrease, is the life of the world to come. In contrast, the Messianic age will be a life within the context of this world, with the world following its natural pattern, except that sovereignty will return to Israel. The sages of the previous generations have already declared there is no difference between the present age and the Messianic era, except the emancipation from our subjugation to the Gentiles.
Okay, So here the Rambam talks about what really is the goal of the what we call Yimot HaMashiach, the Messianic Age. Yeah, but that's instrumental to what goal? Well, he says even a higher level, in order to really, that basically all of humanity will be focused on one subject matter, the knowledge of God, Jew and non-Jew alone, as well. Who will the Mashiach teach? Everybody. In other words, in one sense, Judaism is particularistic, sense, Judaism is universal. In other words, the Torah, in a certain sense, is for everybody. They're not obligating all the mitzvot, but there, as he quotes the pasuk in Isaiah, that ultimately that Jew and non-Jew alone will come to Jerusalem to learn. Who in Tanakh was also a Mashiach and also experienced non-Jews coming to learn from their wisdom?
Abraham,
okay. But this is, but once we were Jewish people. Moshe from, that's really Yitro came, but famously in the Navi, in the prophets. Who was an anointed? I'll give you more hint. Who was anointed king of Israel? What?
Saul.
Well, who came to learn from his wisdom?
King Solomon?
Yeah.
What's her name?
Yeah, what's her name? The Queen of Sheba. From what country?
Ethiopia.
Okay, so that was really, she came to learn his wisdom. Okay, so that's the bottom. In other words, the essence of the Mashiach is going to be the chief educational officer for humanity to give away how to live life properly, how to run a society properly, how to gain perfection, how to understand God, how to weave God's values into our life. And the essential draw will be essentially the power of the wisdom. Okay. And nowadays, now that we have this technology, it's easy that the entire world can be able to see everything. Everybody, you know, truth is, through a simple Zoom thing, you could work it out that everybody would see it. Have one, everybody could see a shear. You have a shear for 8 billion people. Totally possible nowadays. Let's keep on going. Let's have Jane.
In the future, the Messianic King will arrive in the Davidic dynasty, restoring to it to its initial sovereignty. He will build the temple and gather the dispersed of Israel. Then in his days, the observance of all the statutes will return to their previous state.
Okay, so basically the Mashiach's job is to build the Mikdash, gather all the Jews into the land of Israel, and then the all the mitzvahs will be brought back. Right now we don't have a Korban Pesach. We don't have, there are a lot of mitzvahs that we don't have because we don't have a Mikdash. Go on.
Lord Kings chapter 11:4. If a king will rise in the house of David and diligently contemplate the Torah and observe its mitzvot, as described by the written law and the oral law, as David would unfortunately impact all the gifts he walked in the way of the Torah, and rectify the breaches in its observance, and fight the wars of God, we may with assurance consider the Mashiach.
Okay, start right there. So there's two phases. Now, the Mashiach goes, the person who's the king. Does he know that he's the Mashiach?
No.
We will know that the Mashiach is the Mashiach the same moment he is. Why? Because he has to accomplish a task list. As soon as he accomplishes that task, in other words, first of all, he has to be a person who is, as we read before, he has to be great in Torah. And he has to be, and he has the ability to cause the Jewish people to follow Torah. Now, that doesn't mean by he's going to push people to do it, because it has to be through influence of his ideas. So it means he has to be a charismatic educator. Going back to, like, for example, Rav Kook and Rabbi Soloveitchik. People, just to give you a sense, David, by the way, can you put yourself on mute? We're a lot of your opinions coming through.
I don't know what the opinions are, but I'll do that.
So. So, just a quick story. Saturday night, for literally 50 years, Rabbi Soloveitchik gave a shiur Saturday night in Boston. And who would go to this? Reform rabbis, Jews of every kind. And he says, and he felt a tremendous stress to give a good shiur. Why? Because he's competing with the movies. Because Saturday night, what are you going to do? You know, after Shabbos, you're going to go to the movies. So he really brought out these, you know, whopper awesome shiurim that people went for literally decades. Decades. As you know, look, you might go to a particular class once or twice, but to be so interested, you're going to go to the guy's shiur for decades. That means it's phenomenal. And to be able to engage people who are, again, remember, Boston is the college town of America. You have people from Harvard and MIT, and you have very brilliant people there. And people who have all, people who went from all denominations went to this shiur. And that's just most, right now we're in very divided in denominationally. But there, he was able to have that effect that people felt comfortable, didn't feel he had to be Orthodox to come to the class, and it was very accessible. So that kind of idea, in other words, it's not he forced people to come to this year. This year was so damn awesome, he wanted to show up. You know what I'm saying? That's what I'm talking about. The Mashiach will be that plus on steroids, okay? We keep on, we go on. Let's go on.
Okay. If he succeeds in the above, builds a temple in his place and gathers his first of Israel, he is definitely the Mashiach.
Right, so he goes through first. There's a category one called Beth Keskat Mashiach. He's assumed he's likely the Messiah, but not for sure. But when he finishes his last two jobs, which is build the Mikdash in the place and gather the ingathering, then he's for sure the Mashiach. Okay? But there's a lot of education to get, even forget about the non-Jew. Getting the Jews on the same page about anything is a massive job. Okay? All right, so we go on.
He will then improve the entire world, motivating all the nations to serve God together. As Zephaniah states, I will transform the peoples to a pure language, and they will all call upon the name of God and serve him with one purpose. If he did not succeed to this degree or was killed, he surely is not the Redeemer promised by the Torah. Rather, he should be considered as all other proper and complete kings of the Davidic dynasty who died. God caused him to arise only to test the many, as Daniel states, and some of the wise will stumble to try them, to refine and to clarify until the appointed time, because the set time is in the future.
Okay, so who did the wrong kid? Who did the Jews think, not only any Jews, but Rabbi Kiva and the people of the generation think was a likely Mashiach candidate? Historical question.
The guy that converted to Muslim?
No.
Bar Kokhba.
Yeah, Bar Kokhba. Bar Kokhba, who led the revolt in 132, who they felt that he was bringing back Jewish sovereignty, and he had the qualities that he's going to be, that's how they prove, right? So the Rambam says, how do you know that you don't have to be a miracle worker? He doesn't have to perform any miracles, because why? They thought Rekiva and his other rabbi felt that this guy's a candidate and he didn't do any miracles. He just was an awesome general. Okay? So, all right. So, there's a lot of juicy stuff here. Okay, let's keep on going. So, the key point here is that, just to put it all into a neat little bundle here, that Moshe is really, in a certain sense, the first Mashiach. He's anointed by God to be the Jewish leader, the king. But the king is not just to be a military leader. That's one role. He's there to principally to be an educator. And also educated from a sort of a sage on the stage kind of thing. And also to be like an R-O-N-F person who's able to deal with people who are at different places and do it in a therapeutically effective manner. Okay? That's the Mashiach personality. Educate, inspire everybody, and also be able to capacity, and also, but when you have to notice, I don't know if you look at the top of the page there, what also does he have to do?
Lead.
Fight the war of the of God. There are, sometimes you have to fight. For example, there's an obligation in the time that when the Jews came in, they had to fight which nation?
Uh-huh.
Amalek. Okay, now, by the way, even Amalek's allowed, you can offer, if they will accept the peace treaty, then you don't fight them. Interesting. Ram has that if they accept peace, which means they become B'nai Noah, they abandon idolatry. Okay. So there could be a peace treaty even with a Moloch, because then they're really not ideologically Moloch anymore. Okay. So
are these wars considered offensive? Or let's say he's gonna compel all of Israel to walk in the way of Torah. You know, compel is an interesting word and
well, compel, but since he's not,
is it more like convince, or is it more like you're literally, is it kind of what's going on in Muslim style.
I say it would be principally compelled with its force of personality and the strength of his ideas. In the same way, did Martin Luther King compel America to take civil rights seriously? Yes. But he maintained the belief of passive resistance. He didn't, unlike his other, Malcolm X and others who maintained taking a militant approach, he maintained that to do it through influence. So that really is the general way of the Torah is a balance, is what they call Darchi Noam. We sing it when we put the Torah away. Darchi Noam, according to the Shalom, ways of pleasantness and peace. So that's a component. But simultaneously, we're not pacifistic. So there is a time when you're not going to convince a Nazi to not be a Nazi. You have to sometimes you have to shoot the guy. Okay? Now, again, that's not done on an individual level. It's done on a state level. It's a very important point. There's no vigilantism. It has to be that a state makes a decision. Not like a terrorist is taking justice in their own hands. So that's just a little place. So what you want to take away, just to spend a moment of visualization, if you imagine whatever picture you have of simultaneously Moshe and of the Mashiach in the future, to try to graft these three persons that I just shared with you tonight, who have to get a sense on their personality, sense of these different features, because what you want to accomplish is to make Moshe Rabbeinu, and by extension every character in Tanakh, a real world person. Now take him out of the childish comic book mythology and get a sense of what he would kind of be like. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So far as personality, so far as mentality, so far as because they're going to be extensions of those three people. Obviously, none of them are as good as Moshe, obviously, they're all Moshe-esque in a certain way. Even though, say, Jabotinsky wasn't personally observant, but very passionate about the Jewish people, very proudly Jewish, you know what I'm saying? There's a tremendous value in that. And one of the things that he was, I didn't highlight this point, he was a very big advocate of part of being militant is having Jewish pride, having Jewish dignity. The Jews in diaspora were always cowering in the face of the various oppressors, Cossacks, various people who were victimizing Jewish people. So he means that we have to take back and have a vision of a strong Jew, a confident Jew, a proud Jew. And he's 100% correct about that. In other words, because who gave us the narrative of being weak? The Gentiles did. They put us into that role. So he's trying to internally change the sense of you are confident, you can defend yourself, you learn how to know how to shoot a gun, you are a person who will at the appropriate time assert your right of existence and dignity. And that gives, by the way, the IDF gives the Jewish people a sense of dignity to communicate to the world that Jewish blood is not cheap. If you're going to take some of us down, there will be consequences. Not going to be like 1903 at the Kishinev pogrom anymore. Those days are over. So this is one part intellectual and one part emotional to sense a personality of a Moshe as being a political figure, a religious figure, a spiritual figure, but which is, you can sort of sense a little bit, a little taste a little bit. Okay? I'm not giving a traditional shear in that sense. Is that clear a little bit? Because why do we do this exercise? Because once you see him as a real world figure, what he does starts to make a lot more sense. And also your questions about what he's doing, why would somebody who's like that do this? So in a certain sense, it's going to accelerate the depth of understanding of what really the dynamics of Moshe Rabbeinu throughout the finish. You know what I'm saying? It's accomplishing two goals simultaneously. Okay, I want you to think about that tonight. Okay, guys.
Thank you. Yes. You said, if certain communities refer to Rav Soloveitchik as the Rav,
yes.
You're an Efrat, you say the Rav.
Then they're all confused. But we'll ask you for clarification. That's good.